Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. It's raining here in New York, but it is still so beautiful out, and I'm so happy to have this rain because all of my gardens and lawns need it badly. Every time it rains, it saves me a few hours of having to manually water everything, so I'm always happy when it's spaced out well. So anyway, I'm welcoming the rain. Lots of things to talk about in the news and ways you can take action. This week in my newsletter, I wrote about the farmers in India committing suicide in record numbers, and it's just so disturbing. The pandemic has, hit poor communities worse than ever and poor countries worse than ever. And the strict lockdown has prevented farmers, many of which had side jobs, from being able to do those extra jobs to help keep their farms going. And it's just devastating. Since the pandemic, I think they said like 10,000 farmers have already committed suicide. So it's just heartbreaking, and I don't know that they see any end in sight. So I wrote about that, and then the Farmers to Families Food Box Program, which I wrote about early on when they first started it with this pandemic, and was really optimistic that it was going to help farmers find avenues for their produce that they all of a sudden didn't have avenues for. And it is doing that somewhat, but instead of course, going to the small farmers, it's going to the big corporate farmers. And the U.S. government is paying way more than what they should for the box. This article in the New York Times is talking about each box being worth maybe $26 to $35, and the government's paying $100 for it. So something's not right. And the boxes, which were supposed to be being delivered and taking the expense of trucking off of the food banks, has not really come through, and the food banks are being billed for the trucking. Anyway, it has not panned out to be the way it was. And yet, of course, the current administration is trying to tout it as being a great success. And it's just another false statement coming out of the White House. And I'm really excited. In a little bit, I'll be introducing my guest this week to you, Roberto Borrero. He is an activist, and I will tell you more about him in a little bit. He's going to be coming on talking to us about the Climate and Racial Justice March that's coming up on September 20th. I also wanted to talk to you about school meals. Do you believe it that as a food farm-to-school coordinator for our local public school, I still do not know how we are going to be serving food to our students? And as of right now, I am just permanently on hold while they figure it out. It seems like the school meals will be bagged up, and it will be a grab-and-go situation where they're going to be eating in the classroom. And I would love to be in there putting a healthy, locally produced seasonal salad in those lunch bags. But as of now, that has not happened. But the good news is that the USDA is extending the summer program, which has more lenient restrictions. Actually, this summer they had no restrictions because of the pandemic, allowing all students to get the meals for free. And they're extending that into the school year. So now through December, all students will be able to pick up those meals and take them into their classroom and eat them and not have to pay for them. And that is just so wonderful because it's leveling the playing field. Everyone has access. No one should be hungry. Of course, many schools are still virtual and the students aren't in the school. So in years past, it had to be the child picking up the food. But now, of course, they're allowing the parents to pick up the food as well. So, how the local school districts are distributing it is different in every school district, so you need to find out. But it is just a lifesaver for so many people to have access to food during this time. The food insecurity rate has, tripled since this pandemic has started, and it's just heart-wrenching how many people are really struggling to put food on the table. So this free breakfast and lunch will really help so, so many families, and that's really, really great news. Some ways that you can take action. Climate Week is coming up, starting September 20th, and there's a kickoff march, the Climate and Racial Justice March on September 20th, and so we want to have everybody who is able and feels safe enough to come out with face masks and participate. This one will be in New York City. There's different actions all across the country for Climate Week, so you need to go into your local areas and search that. But we need to not forget that this climate crisis is here and it's not going anywhere, and the pandemic has taken a lot of the attention of the climate crisis away, but we really need to keep it, you know, front and center, because it's not going anywhere and it's getting worse. And in the name of the pandemic, the current administration has, where they have already weakened so many regulations, they are doing it even more, saying that, you know, corporate polluters don't have to be accountable for what they're dumping. And it's just, you know, moving in the wrong direction. We really need to bring it back to front and center. And we're hoping that this kickoff march will do that. And we'll be talking more about that in just a little bit. There's also, as you all know, fracking in New York State has been banned for many years. Cuomo did that many years ago. However, he still supports a lot of the infrastructure, meaning the liquefied gas terminal stations, the trucking of toxic waste from Pennsylvania fracking sites into New York. Right now, this one is about the Gibson Town fracked gas export terminal, which will have ships, you know, going down the Delaware River, you know, being trucked thousands of miles to get there. And at the same time, the liquid gas is all for export. It's not even, you know, fuel that we need in this country. It's all for export. So it's all for the profit of these companies. And yet we, as the people who live here, we have to take all the risk. And it just does not make sense. And of course, even when there's spills, very often they're not the ones having to pay for cleaning it up. It's the taxpayers paying for cleaning it up. So we just need to stop the fracking altogether. But in the meantime, we need, you know, Governor Cuomo, who is a part of the committee, to vote against the permission for this fracked gas terminal. So please go on my website and sign that petition. And now I want to share with you my weekly recipe. I've been doing so much cooking. There's so much cooking coming out of the garden. But I thought I'd take a little break and give us a little treat of a oatmeal raisin cookie that I created yesterday. And it's gluten-free and vegan. I've been doing full vegan now since the new year, and it's just been really wonderful. You know, I don't feel like there's any vegan police coming around. So, you know, if I taste something that someone has that might have a little bit of ghee in it or milk in it or something, you know, I know I'm still going to live. But in the, you know, for the most part, I'm really staying on a vegan diet for my health and the planet. And it's just, you know, once you make that commitment and that transition, it just feels really good. And at the same time, careful not to be dogmatic about it, room for everybody, but helping people see that within those boundaries, there's a lot of freedom. And so working within the vegan boundaries, creating some really great recipes, and so I'm really looking forward to continuing sharing them with you. So these oatmeal cookies I made also gluten-free, which I'm doing a lot of, not because I have an allergy with it, but many friends of mine do, and since, especially with cookies where you're making enough to share with everyone, I decided to make them gluten-free. So here you go. These are the ingredients. 1 tablespoon of ground flaxseed, 1 tablespoon of chia seeds, 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar, and 2 tablespoons of water. And those right there, when you mix together, that is my replacement for an egg or two eggs. And I just mix that together in a little bowl and set that aside and let it become glutinous, kind of like thick and sticky, and that helps bind the cookies together. Then you also need 1 cup of ground oats. So I grind the oats first and then measure out a cup. 1 cup of ground walnuts. 1 cup of gluten-free flour. 1 1/4 teaspoons of cinnamon. 1 teaspoon salt. 1 teaspoon baking powder. 1 teaspoon baking soda. 2 teaspoons vanilla. 3 cups of organic gluten-free oats. 1 1/4 cup of maple syrup. 1 cup of organic coconut oil. And 1 1/2 cups of raisins. So I start by just getting set up. I line a cookie sheet with some parchment paper, and I spray that with either a coconut oil spray or a canola oil spray, or not even olive oil would work. But you just want to spray the parchment paper so that the cookies don't stick. Then in a small bowl, I mix the flaxseed, the chia seeds, the apple cider vinegar, and the water, and I let that sit until it became thick and glutinous. I measured out 1.5 cups of the raisins, and I covered that with boiling water and just let that sit until I needed it. I combined all the dry ingredients, except for those raisins that are soaking in water, in a large bowl. And then in an electric mixer, I combined the coconut oil and the maple syrup and the vanilla. And when you mix that up, it doesn't get light and fluffy the way mixing butter and sugar would. But it does mix up, and it actually... it doesn't fully mix up. When you look at it, you'll see little pieces of the coconut oil in there mixed in with the maple syrup. But it does a better job than you can do by hand. And then I added the vanilla and the flaxseed mixture to that and mixed it a little bit more. Then I added those wet ingredients into the bowl with the dry ingredients and mixed it up well. Then I drained the raisins and added those raisins to the cookie batter. And again, I mixed it well. Then I use a cookie scoop, which looks like an ice cream scooper, except it's a little small. It's the size of, it's a perfect size for making a cookie. And I just scooped out the cookies evenly spaced onto a cookie sheet, leaving, about an inch in between the cookies so that there's some room for them to spread out. I baked them at 350 degrees for 7 minutes, turned the cookie sheet pan and baked it for another 5. So it's about 12 minutes total. Everyone's oven is different. My back of my oven is always hotter, so I always have to turn the cookie sheets so that the back ones and the front ones cook evenly. And then I remove them from the oven, let them cool. And when they cool, they become crisper. The centers are still a little chewy, and they're just delicious. I wrap them up, and then a few hours later when I was eating them in the evening, they had become a little, not soggy, but, they weren't still crispy like they were right when they came out of the oven and cooled. So if you put them back into the oven right before eating them and let them cool again, they'll come back to being crispy. So if you like your oatmeal cookies crispy, you can do that too. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week. Roberto Boerio is one of the organizers for the March of Climate Justice Through Racial Justice, which is taking place on September 20th. And Roberto has a distinguished and diverse background in both policy and program development and human rights advocacy, including a specialization in the rights of indigenous people. He has over 20 years' experience actively engaging the United Nations in thinking more thematically about things such as sustainable development, climate change, the information society, and the Organization of American States. He has served on the staff of the International Indian Treaty Council and the American Museum of Natural History, as well as an independent contracting consultant for UNESCO, PBS, and other notable institutions. Roberto is a published writer, an accomplished artist, and a musician. He's a member of the Taino Tribal Nation, an indigenous peoples whose traditional homelands extend through the Greater Antilles to the southern tip of Florida in the United States. In 2012, he was traditionally sanctioned as a cacique, I'm not positive if I'm saying that right, cacique chief of the Guinea Taino Tribal Community. He has an educational background in communications and cultural studies, and in 2013, he was awarded an honorable doctorate degree in philosophy and humanities from Kiowa International University in Uganda. And I'm thrilled to have him on. So, Roberto, are you with me?
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
Ah, my pleasure. I'm so thrilled with, you know, learning about all the things that you're involved in and what you're doing. It's just fascinating. So I thought you could share with my audience first a little bit about you and about your people.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for that introduction. I think you shared some of the work that I've been involved in over the years, and so maybe I'll focus a little bit more on my people, who are the Taino, as you mentioned, indigenous peoples from the Caribbean island region, whose traditional homeland extended throughout those islands into even the southern tip of Florida in the U.S. And my own family lineage comes from the island of Boriquín, which most people today know as Puerto Rico. And I think it's important to understand that, because the Taino have an interesting place in history, as we were the first indigenous peoples that Columbus met in 1492. We were the first peoples to be called Indians, and the first to suffer oppression and genocide as a result of the brutal colonization and a lack of just transition that occurred during that time. So for me, I understand the Caribbean islands to be the ground zero for the colonization of the Western Hemisphere, and also the transatlantic slave trade, which was started by Columbus, by the way. So as a Taino, I see this as the beginning of an over 500-year-old, well-documented spiritual devaluation of human natural resources.
Uh-huh. You there?
Yes, yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I think that it really plays a real important part about why I do gives you some background on why I do the things that I do. It's of course, as a human being, I feel we all have a responsibility to be a part, but also as part of my ancestral culture, I also feel that I have a responsibility to not only the present, but future generations.
Mm-hmm. And have you lived in Puerto Rico, or you live in New York now?
I live in New York now, yeah.
Uh-huh. And were you born here, or were you born in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, I was. My family comes from the island. Both my parents were born on the island. They came here. I was born here in New York, but fortunately, I was brought back and forth quite regularly and was very well aware of my culture and who I was, thanks to my family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so important to keep that alive. You know, the first year I went to the Slow Food Festival in Turin, Italy, called Terra Madre, the mm-hmm. focus was on indigenous tribes. And they had, indigenous tribes from around the world, all in their natural, or their traditional costumes and speaking their traditional language. And the focus was, trying to keep the indigenous languages alive, because it seemed like people were really afraid of losing that culture, and then also their food, the traditional food that your people and other indigenous tribes eat. Is that something that you've also looked into in food?
Oh, of course. I think that's a really a critical issue, especially when you talk about an island like Boriquín. We say Boriquín in the Taino language, or Puerto Rico, where they're importing about 80% of the food product in the island, which can, has a year-round growing season, has traditionally agriculture was a focus of our peoples. And so, if we can grow food there, if we can engage in low-impact agriculture enough to feed communities, why are we importing so much food from outside?
Right.
And there's, of course, there's a reason for that. There's links to colonization. There's other things that we can go on with. But I think that now, as a result of the hurricanes and other disasters that have befallen the island, including the COVID pandemic. Now people are really starting to look again at their food security and also looking towards food sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. And are there any traditional foods that your people used to eat that is being rediscovered, you know, or that never really was lost but is being promoted now? Is there anything that, like, I wouldn't know of, whether it's cassava or, you know, kohlrabi?
Yeah, I mean, the cassava, was a traditional food staple for our community. We call it yuca. That's a Taino word. It's related to other indigenous words from other communities around the region. But this was a staple food, and I think that things like this are coming back in a stronger way, although they've always been present. With colonization, there's a push for other type of things, right? And people kind of fall, your own traditional foods kind of lose the value, they lose their value in that kind of push. So I do think that there's a rise in all kinds of traditional foods, and things are making a comeback, and youth are really coming into this now. There's a large movement of youth going back and working with agriculture, understanding the traditional methods, trying to understand traditional methods, but also take in good practices that have evolved over time. And so, yeah, we see all of that. I mean, yuca, maize, the corn, you know, there's just, I mean, on the tropical island, there's just always so much, right, that you can do there and grow, and, you know, superfoods and things that people are going towards now. You know, all of that is found in the tropics, from the islands all the way down throughout the region, throughout Central and South America. I mean, there was always interchange and of foodstuffs and cultures, and I think that traditional is really coming back now.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right, and it's, you know, really exciting. I know I've only been to Puerto Rico once, but, you know, wherever I go, I try to seek out the slow food community, because then I know I'm going to, you know, get some of the realness of the people that live there. And so I actually went to a slow food meeting in San Juan when I was there and met some of the farmers that are growing the food. And, yeah, it was great. They're really, you know, looking to bring back a lot of the traditional food. So that was really exciting. But I want to just change direction a little, because I want to talk about the climate march that's coming up, the Climate Justice Through Racial Justice March. I know you're involved in promoting that, and I was just curious, how did that idea come up, and you know, what is the inspiration behind having this march now?
Well, yeah, great question. I think that if we look back over this decade, we've had like two major people's climate marches. There was the one in New York that took place in 2014, and it was like one of the largest mobilizations at that time. And people, I think, were really inspired by that march. And then there was another one that took place in Washington in 2017. And of course, there's been other marches since then. And there was a very large march, for example, last year, the Youth Climate March. But as someone who's been involved in the, you know, in some aspects of the organizing of all these events, you know, I know that there's been internal and external critiques about representation of people of color, you know, basically calling for the climate justice movement to really center on frontline communities. And that's because we know that really in any crisis, it's the poorest and the most vulnerable that suffer the greatest impacts. So I think that introspection has continued here in New York and around the nation, and really has amplified along with the rise in demands for racial justice since the murder of George Floyd. So, you know, looking at all this, what I find as really an interesting aspect to this current situation is that, you know, even though we think that we've come such a far away, we've come very far, but we can also see that the opposition to all these calls for racial justice, that rise in opposition and that outward, really just backlash to it all, I guess you could say, that that's really based in racism and ignorance and privilege, you know, really shows that we have a long way to go to achieve the equity that we're demanding at this time. So, you know, why now? Yeah. It's like, why not now? We have to do this. We're in a climate crisis, and we see what's going on the ground as far as racial issues and racial injustice. And we really need to come out of our siloed thinking and work together and really ask ourselves at this time, you know, what skills and, you know, what resources am I putting out there, or this house is on fire and we really need to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the connection between racial justice and climate justice? Because I think people get the climate crisis, at least, you know, most of the people that I know. You know, I think, you know, it's obvious, you know, the storms are coming, you know, even people who are, you know, right-leaning, you know, other than the person living in the White House, acknowledge that the climate crisis is real. But when it comes to racial justice, making the connection as to how it affects the poorer communities more, maybe you can just talk a little bit about that, because I think people don't really realize that, you know, so much of the climate crisis, like if you're going to have, you know, a liquid power plant, you know, it's going to be in a, you know, indigenous community or people of color community. It's not going to be in your white upper middle class community. So maybe you can just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure, and great points that you just made. I think that's really important for people to understand, so I thank you for that. But, you know, since we know that the poorest and the most vulnerable are suffering the greatest impacts of the climate crisis, right, we also know that Indigenous peoples, Black people, and other people of color are disproportionately represented amongst the most vulnerable and marginalized peoples. So from my perspective, you know, as a Taino person, as an Indigenous person, you know, there's a real historic context to our current situation. And there's like a direct line from colonialism, slavery, and this just ravenous exploitation of natural resources to the current issues that we face of environmental, climate, and racial justice. So I feel that what we're speaking about here is a legacy of extraction. We're talking about removing resources and peoples from lands and systems that once provided for all of the community, to people who are now, for example, getting substandard foods and little or no access, actually, to healthcare, among other things. So, you know, as an Indigenous person who's engaged in this sort of work for climate and racial justice, you know, I think that we understand the need to decolonize. I think for us, it's really linked to colonization. And so we try to engage intersectionally, you know, based on the historic realities of the past that continue to affect our present and will affect our future generations. And I think you mentioned, you know, some of the things in your lead into this question. And, you know, but again, from my perspective, like if you look at it this way, when these colonizers first arrived, you know, they took lands, they disrupted systems that, in my view and the view of my ancestors, sought more harmony with the earth, and they replaced them brutally with ones that really disrupted or extracted from all these natural systems with no thought about reciprocity or really any concept of sustainability. So they chopped down trees, right? They polluted waterways, and they moved people from healthy eating. You were just mentioning this going back to traditional food and slow foods. But, you know, colonization, that interruption, that disruption, that oppression really moved us away from that, from the eating that we did, that traditional lifestyle that kept our people healthy. And really then on top of that, they, because of this power imbalance, they really rigged the system to disadvantage Indigenous peoples and Blacks and other peoples of color. So you fast forward a few centuries, And so our communities today, as you mentioned, either in the urban or the rural areas, you know, we're disproportionately affected. As you mentioned, they could be some polluting infrastructure in areas where our people live, and not putting them in areas that you mentioned where it might be a white upper middle class, you know, society, right, community. And so, you know, because of our people have been subjected to all of this, you know, we're really disproportionately affected by diseases like diabetes, heart disease, asthma, and upper respiratory disease, and, you know, a host of other debilitating health conditions. So when, you know, when folks are out at demonstrations demanding racial justice today, and, you know, we hear people of color saying, "I can't breathe," you know, of course we understand that that's linked to chokeholds and police brutality, and those also have a historic context in relation to peoples of color, indigenous peoples and other peoples of color. But, you know, if these same people were saying they can't breathe, right, the same people who are getting choked disproportionately have health conditions like asthma, you know, like, you know, due to external forces not of their making, which also takes their breath away, right? You know, we have to make the connections between the environment, the climate, and racial justice. I think Eric Garner, you know, we found out when he was killed, he also had asthma. So, you know, there's really an environmental justice issue going on there. And, you know, really, as a person, and, you know, I'll wrap this up here, but as a person whose family comes from Boriquen or Puerto Rico, you know, I know that the loss of life of people on the island that they suffered during Hurricane Maria, it wasn't just simply the result of, you know, this external weather event that we know is that climate change contributes to. But, you know, we can also say that about Hurricane Katrina, right? That, you know, there's these extreme weather events, but the loss of life there is not only just because of the event, and the event that doesn't stand alone. The casualties are also the result of a longstanding colonial legacy that includes racism and years of neglect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not just the weather event, as you said. You know, they're already marginalized. They're already compromised because of their lack of funds to escape it or to go to a hotel, or, you know, they're even talking about, you know, here, the wildfires that are happening in the Pacific Northwest, you know, are evacuating complete towns, and a lot of these people don't have places to go, and they're not setting up shelters because they don't want, with the pandemic, you know, I was listening on NPR, they were talking about how the government said they were going to put everybody up in hotels, but all the hotels are full. That's not happening. And so people are, you know, being sent away who, you know, a lot of the fires are going through like mobile home communities where, you know, people don't have the resources to put themselves up, you know, to drive hours, to put themselves up. Many of the people don't even have cars. They're hitchhiking to get away from the fire. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, vulnerable communities, you know, and these extreme weathers, you know, they're already compromised before the extreme weather situation already happens.
And if I could just add that, you know, and it's because of that racism, right, that they're already compromised. There's a historic complex context of why they've been put in these positions over, you know, generations. And there's a history of the oppression of these communities. I mean, here in New York, we know that there was a recent news report that, you know, that surfaced that showed that, you know, it was a directive of real estate agents to keep black people out of certain communities in suburban Long Island, right? Like that they were tasked with doing that. So we know that this was, you know, a really conscious oppression, right? It just didn't, you know, end at one time. I mean, you know, this is all what Dr. Martin Luther King marched for. This is what Malcolm X was speaking about. And this is really what the American Indian movement in the 1970s was about. It's about this, you know, inequity, this ongoing oppression. And, you know, so we have to make those links to between climate change and racism. And finally, you know, you mentioned the California fires. You know, I think now that there's people are also understanding that the traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples could also have made a difference, you know, for some of these fires, that traditional fire keeping and understanding that those smaller burn fires that the traditional indigenous peoples engaged in over centuries that kept, you know, a lot of this underbrush from the California fires would have made a difference in many of these cases. And I think folks are starting to look at indigenous peoples now, you know, not only for their knowledge in food and seed saving and those things, but also, you know, our sciences, right? That fire management over generations that we've learned, and not only that, but our ethics, right? Our values and our worldview.
Mm-hmm. So important, so important. We're going to take a couple minute break. When we come back, I'd like to, you know, ask your opinion or to share with us what it would look like, you know, climate justice through racial justice, what it would look like on the ground. You know, how would that manifest in terms of policy? And that's going to be an in-depth discussion, so we'll start it when we get back after our break. So everyone, if you're just joining us, my guest is Roberto Borrero. He is a climate justice and racial justice activist and so much more, and we'll be right back.
This is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food, and you're listening to PRN, your source for progressive, up-to-date, and inspirational information on nutrition and health.
Stay up to date with PRN for the latest on the coronavirus. Learn ways to stay spiritually vibrant and physically strong on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. Don't forget to catch The Gary Null Show, the number one progressive radio program in America. Hear the mind, heart, and soul of the progressive voice, Gary Null, on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio Network is a thinking person's network for our world's progressive visionaries and stakeholders and great thinkers to assemble on a commercial, free, and listener-supported network. Our provocative hosts speak freely and passionately on intriguing and urgent topics such as health and news and politics and women's issues and philosophy and more that directly impact our lives. Progressive Radio Network takes chances. Our voices and ideas are not always welcomed by corporate media, so Progressive Radio Network is a very important outlet for these great thinkers.
Hi, this is Paul Capilcante, host of The Vinyl Experience, and you're listening to PRN, your source for the best in progressive conversation, news, and entertainment.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roberto Borrero. He is a climate and racial justice advocate and is one of the organizers for the march that's coming up on September 20th. Right before the break, I was asking him, what would it look like what would climate justice through racial justice actually look like in terms of policy? So that's where we are right now. Roberto, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Great. So maybe you can talk about that. Like, how would what we're advocating for actually look like in terms of policy?
Yeah, I think this is a bold question, and I think that, you know, this is what we as racial justice and climate justice advocates are really focused on in a lot of these actions. I mean, you know, we don't just do these actions just to, you know, voice our concerns, but we're looking to make change, real change that will affect people on the ground. And, you know, so one thing is trying to enact policy that, you know, really takes into consideration the communities that we're talking about and will make a difference for them. So, I mean, I think that, you know, with push from a lot of climate activists, you know, New York State, for example, in 2019 passed this Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. And that basically, you know, according to the to what was written about it, is to empower every New Yorker to fight climate change at home, at work, and in their communities. And so, you know, this is building upon years of advocacy, but it also takes, you know, leadership that wants to embrace these kind of issues. And, you know, there's always, you know, give and take in these type of things. But I think that's a real good, was one good really step forward, you know, that there was a number of targets actually set for the state. And this could really provide an example for other states who haven't engaged in other types of actions like this. But, you know, one of the things that at least the organizers of the march that were involved in on September 20th, Climate Justice Through Racial Justice, one of the things that we've also wanted to highlight was that, you know, New York City also recently passed a resolution 864 that declared a climate emergency. And I think that's also important, although we know the limitation of resolutions as far, you know, when we compare them to acts. But, you know, these things are done to raise the visibility of these issues. And I think that is key, because by declaring it a climate emergency, we're not just talking about climate change, which seems a little bit more passive, like there's time to do something. This really takes it into the mode of climate crisis, right? This is an emergency. This is what I was kind of alluding to before. The house is on fire, and we really need to do something about it. We really need to have action now. So, you know, we're talking about in this, right? We're talking about immediately halting any investment in fossil fuels, for example, Canadian hydropower and any other related infrastructure. And, you know, talking about not just, you know, way down the road, but we're talking about, you know, a real fast tracking to meet carbon, zero carbon emissions, at least a zero carbon emissions economy, right, by at least 2030. And we're hoping and demanding for a powerful public process and structure for implementation of these initiatives that are led by, right, and prioritize the voices and need, again, of frontline communities. I think that has to be essential for everything that we do. We really have to think about those who are most effective. And so that would also include not only indigenous peoples, black and brown communities, but, you know, including working people and youth. And as I mentioned before, you know, I brought up the idea of indigenous traditional knowledge. And I think that, you know, in these discussions, in these policy decisions, I think that's also important, because it's not just the science, as I said, that's important in this, but there's an ethics, right? There's an understanding, a worldview that can really, all people can benefit from, you know, one that really looks not only at the present, but also to the future generations. So,
let's talk about that. You're talking about the seven generations concept that is, you know, fundamental in indigenous communities. Can you talk about that, the seven generations?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, the seventh generation principle is really based on Haudenosaunee or Iroquois worldview. And basically that's it really kind of codifies in thought this idea that the decisions that we make today should result in a sustainable world seven generations into the future, right? So this is a concept that's not limited, of course, to the Iroquois, but I think that they coined the phrase seven generations, so we have to give them the credit for that. However, you know, across indigenous cultures, we're always looking at sustainability. For example, in my own Taino culture, you know, we were agriculturalists, we were diplomats, we were, you know, ocean-going peoples who went across island to island and into the continent. But, you know, at the local level, we understood one of the things that our ancestors did was collect turtle eggs, right, as part of their sustenance. Obviously, can't be doing that much today because turtles are endangered. But at that time, you know, they were plentiful. And the reason that they could do that is because they knew, right, that you couldn't collect, if you collected all the turtle eggs, there'd be no turtles the next season. So you had to do that in a sustainable manner so that the turtles would return and that your future generations would be able to benefit from the actions that you would do in that present time. So really our philosophies were based on need and not greed. And so I think that that's a concept that, you know, really needs to permeate into the mainstream. You know, we have this over-consumptive, you know, production and consumption mindset that just, you know, really just devours the natural resources, like thinking that, you know, all these things are infinite. They're not infinite, they're finite. And, you know, the things that we're doing now is affecting us at this moment. But, you know, I have children, and in my community, you know, we have people who are multi-generational, meaning there's grandchildren, there's a whole gamut, right? And we have to think about those folks. What kind of world are we leaving for people? And I think that that's all of our collective responsibility, mm-hmm. and our responsibility to Mother Earth, who in our language we say Atavira.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about need, not greed, you know, and foraging has become so popular. And, you know, traditional foragers knew how to pick ramps and fiddlehead ferns, ramps, mushrooms, how to harvest those out in the wild, but leave enough so that they're going to replenish, so that they'll come back next year. And so many of the people going out and foraging don't have that mindset. They're going out trying to get as much as they can. They're digging it up with the roots, so they're not going to come back the next year. And you know, and really making it so that, you know, if you go to Whole Foods and you want fiddlehead ferns, you got to pay $20 a pound. So I mean, who can afford that? You know, so it's just crazy. this greed mentality and consumption and get as much as you can philosophy that we live in. It's really, you're so right, you know, that example of the turtle eggs, you know, leaving enough behind, taking only what you need is so essential and needed for people to understand. Another issue that has been in the news a lot, the defunding of the police and people freaking out, like, how can you defund the police? We need police to, you know, have law and order. But what are we really asking for when we say defunding the police? We're not looking to totally do away with police. What would defunding the police look like, and how could we then take some of that money and invest it in Black, Brown, and Native communities?
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right there. I think that there's a lot of sensationalism and really partisan fear mongering that's really
intentional.
intentional, especially now that we're around election time, right? You see these political ads that, you know, focus on, you know, some of the harshest aspects of the recent, you know, demonstrations and calls for justice. And, you know, we know, and it's already been reported that many times that people who incite a lot of these events are coming from outside the communities, right, and wreaking havoc in these communities that they don't even belong to. And we saw that in Minneapolis. You know, we mm-hmm. received report from our friends on the ground from the American Indian Movement, you know, that's what they realized was happening, that people were coming in and doing those things. But, you know, to go back to this idea of defund the police, and you know, I think that a lot of media has made this, again, more complicated than it is. And it's really very simple, meaning that we're talking about reallocating or redirecting funding away from the police department and redistributing those funds to places and programs that need it. I mean, it's really that simple. And so, you know, maybe some people might not agree with me on this statement, but I think that even those who are calling for a complete abolishment, right, let me say abolishment, don't necessarily mean that they're, you know, we do away with all forms of, you know, some kind of law enforcement altogether. But I think, you know, really the crux of this, again, this is my view, but the crux of this conversation is really that policing is more about responding to crime, right? And, you know, after it happens, at least that's what we see in neighborhoods of color. It's really responding after. But so it's doing that rather than thinking about the prevention. So, you know, this idea about defunding the police is really about, you know, creating spaces and engaging these issues before they escalate to that situation where we have crimes. And so, you know, just a really quick example is that there's several major cities across the country now that have removed police from the school systems, for example. And, you know, that frees up that funding to do something else in the community that perhaps the community would like to see, or there's other kind of restorative justice efforts or community engagement programs or something else that can help in the preventive aspect of this issue rather than just the response, right? And the response, what we see with the response is, right, this militarization of the police, right, using weapons, chemical weapons, tear gas that are banned for use in real situations, right? Real wartime situations. And so, you know, the issue is complicated. Of course, it's going to take different forms across. But, you know, but I think at the very core, it's really simple. It's about a reallocation of funds to really do the things that we want to see in the communities.
Mm-hmm. If my listeners wanted to get involved, what are some of your favorite community-based projects that advance climate and racial justice?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I really was enjoying your opening monologue that I was able to listen to while I was waiting here for you. And, you know, this discussion about food insecurity, I think, is just critical, you know, at the time, not only because, you know, I have like this ancestral urge, right, to get into the land and work with the land and be part of that. But I think the COVID crisis has really opened people's eyes to this issue, right? Where is food coming from? You know, what happens when supply chains are cut off? And there's a real look at community-based responses to food insecurity. And I'll give you an example, just something that I do. I'm involved in a program in the South Bronx, Friends of Brook Park, a community garden. And we work with community people to get them back in touch. We have a community garden there, get them back in touch with the land, get them planting, understand, of course, you know, without pesticides and all these things, all organic, and linking it and getting. And we've been able to use those vegetables and things that we grow in the park and use that to contribute to responses and food distributions efforts in the community. And so, you know, this is just one thing that people can do at a local level. I'm also working with the Skaticook First Nations, which is one of the indigenous peoples, original indigenous peoples of the New York state area. And they've just been able to acquire some acreage in upstate New York, where they're using that as a way to conserve this tract of forest, but also to make that forest work for them. You mentioned the traditional foragers and the ramps and that, and I really had a really beautiful time recently, of course, with the social distancing and the mask, going up to the Skaticook First Nations land and with my family and planting ramps and you know, understanding that process of food forestry. So agro-food forestry projects are really near and dear to my heart from here, from everywhere, what we're doing in New York, all the way down to the Amazon, where we have, you know, relationships and people are really, you know, when you think about the Amazon, I'm sorry to go off on a tangent here, but people think that these places are just, you know, just kind of developed that way without any kind of human interactions. But you have to think about indigenous peoples who have been interacting with these spaces over generations, the trails that people walk, eating certain foods that they find in the forest, eating those foods, taking them with them on the trails, throwing those seeds out, those things planting. So really, indigenous peoples had a real contribution to the development of ancient forest, right? And at least from the traditional mindset that was based, one, on needed, not greed. Is not to say that we didn't make mistakes over generations, but we were observational people, just like the scientific method. You know, you're looking as observation. I'm sure somebody who ate a plant that was poisonous, you know, the next person figured out, oh, wait a minute, we're not going to deal with that one. We're going to, you know, work with these other things, right? And so that mindset, you know, is really important in this whole discussion. So I think that any kind of community initiative that can help confront food insecurity and get people back to the land is something that I would support. You know, so when there's, for example, you know, they're talking about right now cutting down most of the last track of a forested area on the waterfront of the Hudson and Troy. You know, they'll probably be discussing that today. And, you know, why not leave that last track of land and do something else rather than cut it down for another set of development, you know, housing projects or apartments that not everybody's going to be able to access?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. I had another guest on who was from an indigenous tribe from Cape Cod, and he was just talking about how, you know, the people never made their houses right on the water because of the storms, and also because the water was for everybody. Nobody could own that, you know, and they all, you know, their homes were made set back, and then everybody had access to the water. And, of course, you know, in the Hamptons and the Cape and everything, you know, wealthy people come in and they want to own their piece of the waterfront. And, you know, the most tranquil and beautiful pieces of land really should be accessible for everybody. You know, it's just this ownership is just a whole different mindset as well. So lastly, let's just highlight this upcoming march so that everybody listening really gets it. It's September 20th at 1:00 Columbus Circle, correct?
Yes. And they could, you know, your listeners can get information if they go to the People's Climate Movement New York website. So that's PCMNY.org. And all the information is there. So they talk about, you know, the kickoff and what's, you know, 1 p.m. at Columbus Circle. But they're also giving you you remember, as you said in the beginning, that this is also part of an opening up this climate week, this week of focus on the climate crisis. So there's other events going on that folks in different areas around the city might be interested in. And so, on Wednesday evening, we're going to have a webinar that's going to talk about the intricacies and the intersections of climate, abolition, and decolonization. That's going to happen at 7 p.m. Via Zoom. So that's another event that we're putting together as part of Climate Week, as this coalition of organizations. And and then there's also, if folks want to you know, get involved, there'll also be an art build, and you can get all that information at the website.
On the website, and I'll post those links because we're just out of time. But Roberto, I want to thank you so much for the work that you do. It's awesome, and for joining me today on the show, and, you know, sharing your knowledge with all of my listeners. So thank you so much, and everybody out there listening, thank you for joining, and I'll see you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week, and mark your calendar for September 20th. Bye for now.
Yeah, yeah, man.